All right, our next case is Estrada Puentes versus State, case number 72335. When counsel approaches, please state your name, any kind of co-counsel or any party that might be present. And I'll ask the appellant, do you have any 5 minutes or 4 minutes for rebuttal time?
Yes, ma'am.
4 minutes? All right, that'll be the order. Thank you. You can proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is David Locke, L-O-C-K-I-E. I'm an attorney in Elko, and I'm representing the appellant Eduardo Estrada Puentes in this case. He is not present before. He's in prison. Although members of the family are here. Obviously, from my brief, there are three issues that we've raised. The first two essentially merge. And one is the sufficiency of the evidence and whether, second being whether manual strangulation, if one subscribes to the Washington Supreme Court, whether manual strangulation is rather automatically, if that's the right word, second degree murder. In other words, it can't be first degree murder. And essentially, and the third is the issue potentially of prosecutorial misconduct. The facts as they exist and are set forth in our brief are uncontested. I believe that the state agrees that those facts are uncontested, although the state supplements the facts to some extent. And it's our position that this is a textbook case of voluntary manslaughter. And that was the theory of the case that was advanced at trial. Although the jury was instructed because of the nature of the charge, a first-degree murder or open murder, the jury was also instructed as a second-degree murder. But we really tried the case to a theory of voluntary manslaughter. We never asked the jury to convict of second-degree murder.
But did you object to the second-degree murder instruction?
No. No, the jury was instructed with the first, second, voluntary, and I can't remember involuntary. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any difference because it was never the defense position in this case that some other dude did it or that kind of a theory or some other person did. It was just a matter of what degree of culpability that the jury would come back with. And so if you look at this case, we have the two parties that were together for a pretty long time. Their oldest daughter was 10 years old at the time. They had three kids. They'd separated, and our client, Eduardo Estrada Puentes, had moved down from Elko to Tucson, where he was living with his brother at the time. And he had all three kids down there with him. Voluntarily. There wasn't a divorce yet. They were still married, but it was an agreed upon visit that was taking place, and it was for an indeterminate amount of time. So then he returned to Elko. He borrowed a car from Aubrey Clack, a woman who was his brother's girlfriend, down in Tucson, and drove the kids back up to Elko again. Although there were some aspects that were potentially advanced by the state, but it was a surprise. It really didn't turn out that to be a surprise. The citations in my brief pretty much established that. Because there was communication and text and everything, particularly on the part of the 10-year-old with her mom. So everyone knew that he was coming back, really. And so he got back into town. He dropped the kids off. And then ultimately, the oldest child stayed with Stephanie, the deceased, because and Stephanie was going to stay at her parents' house while Eduardo stayed at the marital residence with the two younger kids. And the idea was Desiree, the 10-year-old, was going to go up the Wild Horse on an outing fishing with Stephanie's parents. And Stephanie was supposed to work at the Scoreboard, which is a kind of a casino out there at Spring Creek, which is a little ways out of town from Elko. And so what happened was Stephanie got up that morning on Saturday, and went over to the marital residence where Eduardo was with the two younger kids, and she brought her stuff to get ready for work, because she left in sweats and that kind of thing, and then she brought her hair dryer and some personal effects to the residence. And, she put her, if you want to call it a uniform or a work outfit, I don't know if it was a uniform, doesn't matter, but her work clothes. She put them in the washing machine, and her name tag was on top of the washing machine. She took a shower, and so forth. The point of all that is nothing leading up to the point in time where I am now, in those early morning hours, would indicate that he formed an intent to harm Stephanie. There were no...
So, Counselor, let me ask you this question. The primary case you're relying on here is this Washington State case, the Bingham right. case. But, first of all, you know, that's a Washington case, and we're not required to follow. But even if we do, okay, let's even accept your argument for a second that that's the case out there and disregard cases from every other state on this issue. But in that case, the Washington Supreme Court concluded that the evidence of manual strangulation wasn't enough for premeditation, and so they reduced the count to second-degree murder. But correct. What you're asking for here isn't that we knock this down to a second-degree murder. It's that this should be manslaughter. So you're actually not even asking us to adopt the Washington case. You're asking us to go beyond the Washington case, aren't you?
No, that's an excellent question. I understand your question. We are asking for second-degree. Just to clarify that, I made the point of what our trial strategy was. For clarification.
Okay, so you're not actually asking for a manslaughter, because that's what I thought your preferred comments were. Okay.
I was kind of struggling to go when I was first talking about that aspect of the case. Yes.
Okay, thanks for the clarification.
Although clearly, you know, our first argument is that this is a voluntary manslaughter case just based upon the sufficiency of the evidence, and that's how we get to the second degree as a matter of law.
You want us to adopt this Washington case, but how do you reconcile the Washington case? Because they're saying as a matter of law, strangulation, boom. And here we're governed by the Byford case in which, and I hear Byford instructions were given.
Right.
Verbatim from the Supreme Court on an open murder charge, it says, look, ladies and gentlemen, here's what one is, here's two, and it describes exactly what we're talking about in the Washington case. Here's voluntary, and attorneys enjoy. You go out there and you make your arguments, and they certainly make their argument as to premeditation deliberation. You go back and you make your argument as to voluntary. How do you reconcile, if we were to do something like that, how do you reconcile that with Byford, which clearly allows the jury to make a decision, not as a matter of law, but based on the facts presented at trial?
Well, what Byford really does is clarify the previous confusion that existed with regards to first-degree murder, and particularly the distinct elements of premeditation and deliberation. Of course, any murder has to be willful. But the two hallmarks that distinguish first and second, which is still, frankly, difficult to completely separate these things out, but Byford purports to do that. And so we have these separate elements of premeditation, and then we have deliberation. And so one thing that I went back and looked at was the Washington statute, wondering maybe if that was a little bit different. And on its face, the Washington statute only says premeditation, but if you look at the case law, including the Bingham case itself, as some states do, they read into the definition of premeditation deliberation. And so even though those aren't statutory elements, those are case law elements. So deliberation is the thought process, weighing the reasons for and against, and then considering the consequences of the action, whereas, of course, premeditation is coming to a decision that you're going to do it. And neither one takes much time, admittedly. So I'm trying to answer your question, and I think that the first part of your question, to me, as I was thinking about this case, would have to do with the statutory distinction between Washington and Nevada. So really, at least from our point of view, the definition of the crimes match up. So that's how I would answer Your Honor's question, is that the definitions are the same. And so, you know, with that Bingham case out there, it's a glaring case that potentially has application in this case, and of course has to be raised here because it's really quite, frankly, it's quite surprising to see that, you know, where it has exactly that much application to this case. So in one respect, if this court were to accept the reasoning in Bingham, this case is essentially over with because there isn't enough to distinguish that Bingham case from this. I understand it's tall order. I well understand it, but I also understand that the case exists. The reasoning primarily that we look at in the Bingham case is that the opportunity to deliberate is not actual deliberation. So that's really the key feature, at least as we see it in that Bingham case, insofar as it speaks to the opportunity versus actual proof of deliberation. The last issue is prosecutorial misconduct, and I will say in front of this court and for the record and anyone else that I've known, Chad Thompson, my opponent here for a long time, at the highest regard for him. He is an ethical prosecutor, but even people who are the most professional and the most ethical can make errors during the course of the trial, and I'll allow the brief to speak for itself with regards to that particular aspect of this case. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 4.5 minutes on rebuttal. Thank you. All right, we'll hear from the respondent.
My name is Chad Thompson. I am from the Elko County District Attorney's Office, and I was one of the prosecutors on this case from charging it all the way through to this point at this juncture. It is our contention that based upon the standard in this case, where you have to review the evidence in the light most favorable to the state and then determine whether a rational trier of fact could find that he was guilty of first-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt, that they are up against the wall here. They cannot prevail on their insufficiency of the evidence issue. The second issue that they raise, it is simply not the law anywhere, not even in Bingham, that as a matter of law, manual strangulation is only second-degree murder. That is not what Bingham says, and I'll get into that in a minute. And the third issue,
you can see manual strangulation being, they could have come back with a voluntary, in this case even. They could have come back with that two voluntary, they could have come back with any of them.
The jury?
Yeah.
Yes, they could.
So even to say, as a matter of law, murder two doesn't sound right.
And the Bingham court doesn't say that. And the Bingham court actually, what they say is if that's the only evidence that you have for premeditation and deliberation, the length of time it takes to strangle someone, they said that's not enough. That's what Bingham actually says. And somehow, in Bingham, they said that the only evidence of premeditation and deliberation, and they focused in on just the time frame. And if you look at the dissent in Bingham, he goes through all of the other facts in the case, and he says, how did they not see this? How did they not see that? And in our view, they violated the standard. They violated the standard of giving deference to the factual findings of the jury, of looking at it in the light most favorable to the state. And I'll give you two examples from the Bingham decision. This is two consecutive sentences. They say, holding a hand over someone's mouth or windpipe does not necessarily reflect a decision to kill the person, but possibly only to quiet her or him. Does that sound like they're giving deference and looking at that evidence in the light most favorable to the state? No. The next question, or the next sentence. Furthermore, here a question of the ability to deliberate or reflect while engaged in sexual activity exists. Again, they're questioning, can a guy who's raping another guy, or this woman, can he at the same time be premeditating deliberating? They are throwing in defense arguments. They are not taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. And this is their last one. Here, no evidence was presented of deliberation or reflection before or during the strangulation, only the strangulation. That's what Bingham stands for. It is a very narrow finding on their part. Somehow, they decided the prosecutor only put forth evidence of the time that it takes to strangle someone. And that is not what we have in this particular case. Bingham is helpful to us as you look to the dissent, because the dissent gets into the facts of it and says, no, these people, or these facts should have been looked at, and it should have been given to the jury, because they could have returned a first-degree murder verdict. And what's important in the dissent of Bingham is the court then, or at least that judge, references this Hounshell case out of Maryland. And Hounshell, if you look at the facts of that case and look at the facts of Bingham, they are very, very close to one another. It's a rape and then a strangulation that occurs afterwards. No deadly weapons. I know that that's a little bit different when we get down that line, whether ligatures are used or cords or such. But those two cases, very different. In Maryland, in the Hounshell case, they upheld the first-degree murder conviction. And they looked at all the other things that were going on at the time. The same thing that we're asking you to do in this particular case. In Bingham, they got stuck on just that one fact, and they said that's the only one that we're going to look at, and we don't think that they applied the appropriate appellate standard. Hounshell is important because the Nevada Supreme Court cited Hounshell approvingly in the Leonard versus State Nevada case. And I apologize, I noticed in my brief that I did not cite the appropriate footnote. It's footnote 16 from Leonard versus State, where they cite Hounshell. And the point of it at that point, and the point of it there, is that the length of time that it takes to strangle someone is another one of those things that a jury may consider in determining whether or not premeditation and deliberation has occurred. We're not talking about that it's the only thing. And that's not what this case is about, because we don't have just that. We have more than that. But they're saying it's absolutely admissible for the jury to deliberate about whether or not premeditation and deliberation occurred based upon the time that it takes there. That's one of the things they can look at. And so when you apply that to this case, you have what happened down in Arizona when he's talking to his daughter. He's talking about killing down there. Granted, he's talking about killing himself, and then he makes a statement he doesn't know what he's thinking. We would suggest that that's evidence of premeditation, that when looked at in the light most favorable to the state, as a reviewing court is required to do, that that's something that you could look at and say, yeah, the jury could look at that as evidence of premeditation. Then you have him coming up when she gets divorce papers. They talk about in their brief, and it's difficult for the defense, and I understand that because they don't want to give it away. But the standard is you have to look at the case in the light most favorable to the state in order to overrule it on a sufficiency of the evidence claim. And here, when Mr. Lockheed talks about in his brief that it was an amicable split, that's not looking at it in the light most favorable to the state. An amicable split, then explain to me why he shows up right after she pulls the divorce papers out. Explain why he tries to liquidate the account the very night he shows up here, and then nearly succeeds in doing so the following day. There were some issues with Vanessa Villegas, who was the one who was in control of the account and getting the right numbers, but they got the wrong routing number. If it's an amicable split, why the search through her phone that morning? If they were okay and they'd been separated for 2 months, and he's seeing other girls down in Arizona, and he knows that she's seeing other guys up here, why the stalking through her phone if it's an amicable split? And you see, that's where the defense, it's difficult to do, and I understand from their perspective. But you have to look at it in the light most favorable to the state. And those things mean something when you start looking at the circumstantial evidence to show the mental state of the defendant. You add those things in with what happens that very morning, that there's an argument, a long argument, a fairly long argument. They can hear them yelling at each other, the children can. And poor Kiana, who is 5 years old, she hears her dad call him, call her multiple times a bitch. And then he hears out the final result of that premeditation and deliberation. You're freaking dead. And then she says it got quiet for like about 5 minutes. The other thing that defense, while they mention it, they don't talk about how in the light most favorable to the state, the bruises on the back of her head, the bruises on her back, the bruise on the back of her arm, the bruise on her, she had a little mark here on her neck, just underneath her collarbone. They talk about those in the cases where that's important because it shows the person's determination to kill. Because they're overcoming whatever defense that there might be, that there was a struggle, and that he was determined enough to go through with that. He had premeditated, he had deliberated. And then you have the amount of time that it takes. And the important thing about strangulation to understand, which I think is probably the most telling thing for any jury, is that after 10 or 15 seconds, you're now holding a rag doll. You can do anything in the world with this person. If you let go, they'll come back. That's what the doctor said. But after 15 seconds, there's no more fighting back. None of that occurs. And now the hard work begins, because it takes...
So, counsel, let me jump you forward a little bit to the misconduct section of the argument. Under Earl versus State, Earl versus State says that prosecutors must avoid statements that ridicule the case. In the closing argument, the prosecutor said, called the defense ridiculous. Isn't the word ridiculous the definition of ridiculing? Literally.
Literally. I understand. But what I was looking at there is that in applying the facts of this case to the law that was presented to the jurors, it was ridiculous. The jury instruction that was given to them, the manslaughter jury instruction reads, that a defendant is not permitted to set up his own standard of conduct and to justify or excuse himself because his passions were aroused unless the circumstances in which the defendant was placed and the facts that confronted him, okay? And so I pinpointed that particular part of my argument. Was he confronted with the kissy face emojis? No. He got her phone and he found them. He looked for something that he could go and excuse his conduct with. And so I said, first of all, that is ridiculous because he's the one who created the situation. The jury instruction says you're not allowed to do that. You can't create the situation and then say, oh, I'm so inflamed right now. And now I can do this. The second part is that it would arouse the passion of the ordinarily reasonable person faced with the same situation. And I, again, brought up the same fact that people are getting divorced all the time. It happens quite a lot that people are unfaithful, unfortunately. These people had been separated for 2 months. He was seeing other girls. She was seeing other guys. They both knew about it. Well, I don't think Stephanie knew about his. I don't think that evidence came out. I strike that. But he was aware that she was seeing other guys. And now he sees the kissy face emoji, and now it's reasonable. A reasonable person based on that would do that sort of a thing. And so I said to the jury, that's ridiculous because we should have murders a lot more often if that's what reasonable people do when they're going through a divorce. And I use that as applied to the facts and the evidence in the case.
I mean, it's all right to argue it as to the facts, no problem. But then to go on and say that the result of manslaughter is ridiculous, this defense is ridiculous, as opposed to the factual statements don't make sense. Because the jury, we know the jury had all the options. So the mere fact that the jury gets an instruction on it means it's not that ridiculous. There's an instruction and an option that the jury could consider.
I could have done it in a different way. It was vigorous advocacy on my part, and if I could have toned it down, then maybe that's the case. But I don't think that it rises to the level of prejudicial conduct that's required for reversal in this.
Well, apparently there was no objection.
There was no objection, so it's a plain error review. And if you look at where the jury came back at first degree murder, they weren't even close to manslaughter. They weren't even close to it if they were deliberating on first degree murder. But there was no objection to it. The other prosecutorial misconduct they talk about is having to do with when I mentioned the movies and TV. And in looking at the argument again, the defense counsel had referenced that they wanted a longer period of time. And our law is a little different than Washington. Washington says at mere moments, it can't be mere moments. Here it could be as quick as successive thoughts. And so I was trying to rein them in on what you might see on TV, where if it's an Agatha Christie novel or something like that, it can be a very long plan by somebody on TV. And those are interesting. They're entertaining. But I was trying to educate them about what successive thoughts mean and how quick somebody can actually premeditate and deliberate and arrive at that conclusion and then commit the murder and still be first-degree murder and not be like movies and stuff on TV. So that's what I was trying to do. The Rose case that they cite with regards to prosecutorial misconduct, in that particular case, they did find that he had committed some errors, and if the use of the ridiculous term was an error at this point, was also so. They didn't even reverse that one. They did not find that it was to the level that required reversal. And so we think that the Rose case, given the facts of this case and how the facts applied to the law as they were instructed to voluntary manslaughter, that while it was a reasonable argument for me to point out how the law did not apply to the facts that we had, if the use of the term were ridiculous, I need to tone that down. I can trust me, I've learned my lesson because I'm here. But I don't think that it rose to the level that required reversal based on that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, we will hear from appellant again. 4 minutes.
Thank you. First of all, with regards to this Bingham case, in Bingham there were bite marks on the decedent, but there's also a sexual assault component to that case. And nevertheless, they still conclude that the evidence was only sufficient to show second-degree murder. So that's obviously goes into the reasoning of that case. I have a hard time thinking that the Washington Supreme Court just forgot about it. We can fairly assume that the court took that into account. In a way, you can look at Mr. Estrada's case as the opinion, and you can look at the dissent as the state's case, because that's where that Hounshell, if I'm saying it right, case does come into play, and it is cited in the Leonard versus State case, as indicated by Mr. Thompson. But the Leonard case is very easily distinguished because that has a ligature that's involved, and the cases are pretty replete with information, or replete with stating the presence of a weapon, infers a first-degree murder. And so that Leonard case is quite clear, and the court was quite clear, and they repeatedly mentioned a ligature strangulation. So the citing of Hounshell in that case is not a dispositive.
They must not have had a felony murder rule in Washington if a person could commit a sexual assault and a murder at the same time, and it's not first degree.
You know, it didn't indicate that there was an actual sexual assault conviction, but there's clearly, you know, aspects of that when you read the case, and I wondered the same thing. So I don't know. I really don't why that wouldn't have been prosecuted in that fashion, because clearly in Nevada, if those aspects were there, maybe didn't think it rose quite to that level.
It isn't the Maryland case similar?
Yeah. Correct. You're talking about a Hounshell?
Right.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I don't know exactly how to distinguish that, or if it was a prosecutorial decision, or the way the case was pled, or how it rolled out. There's not enough information in the cases to get quite to that point. So we didn't contend that the split was amicable. I mean, that way overstates where we're coming from.
Well, you were describing the facts, and the last point you made was she was in the shower, and at that point in time, there was no evidence of intent. But during the shower, wasn't he looking at the phone?
He was, but the aspect of what was on the phone, and that's these emojis and flirtation and kissing type things are what we contend would be a highly provoking type affect on one's mental state from a reasonable point of view. Now, of course, anyone can take a dim view of the fact that a person, as the prosecutor indicated, stalking on the phone or whatever you want to call it, peeking on the phone. But, you know, jealousy is a human foible.
Was there time, though, to come down from that so he's not under the heat of the passion? Even if he got really upset, right, then she's not right in front of him. She's somewhere else.
And we don't know at what point in time any of that occurred. I mean, he didn't testify at trial. And so there really isn't any evidence of the record at what, you know, stage of her showering and so forth that would have occurred. And we actually even just surmised that it was in the shower. But obviously it did occur. That's, I think we agree that it did occur, although we're both inferring from the facts. But nevertheless, that's the type of the human heart being what it is, that jealousy is the kind of thing, if someone's having an affair with another, regardless, even if he himself is having an affair, that's part of the human condition, and that's the highly provoking type situation that fits with involuntary manslaughter.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This case will stand submitted, and we will be in recess. We want to thank the attorneys and all of the parties that came here today. We appreciate the good briefing from both sides and the arguments from both sides. Thank you so much. Stand submitted.